Welcome back to Common Happiness with Sonia Kencare. Today's guest is very special. She was a mentor for me in my writing journey and continues to be an amazing example of a middle grade author, having recently published Sierra Blue and publishing Bull Rider in the recent past. She lives in Reno, Nevada, and I want to give her a chance to tell us a little bit about herself.
Well, there's a big list of things. I've been alive a long time. I live in Reno. When I do school visits, I start by telling kids that I'm a mom, a grandma, and I've been a teacher. That usually makes the group sit up a little bit and pay attention, because I can get my teacher voice on pretty quickly. And we used to say, you know, once a teacher, always a teacher. You don't get away from that. I began writing when I was 40 because I was going crazy. not literally, but I had three kids, a couple of aging parents and in-laws. We had a foreign student from Bolivia living with us, and he and our older daughter were competing for who could be the oldest and most powerful person in our family. And consequently, I started getting up early and writing, and I fell in love with it. So that's the long and the short of it. I've been active in the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators for more than 25 years, and that has been a huge influence on my life. And I have a lot of dear friends from there, including you, Sonia. And I can't get away from writing. I'm not one of those people who writes every single day, but I always have some kind of story or exposition in my mind. And I've spent a lot of time teaching other people what I've figured out by experience and supporting other authors and people. So there, that's my best introduction.
Well, I'm excited to ask you some follow-up questions about that throughout our discussion. But to begin, Susie, are you happy?
Yes, I am. I think I'm basically an optimistic person. And I've been lucky through my life not to have too many terrible challenges, although we all hit those spots where we think things should really be different. But I can generally see that things will change, and I'm always happy to assume that they will change for the better.
How do you define happiness for yourself right now?
It was Freud who said pleasure was the absence of pain. But I really think happiness comes in very small doses and minute by minute. And that's one of the lessons that I have taken to heart over the years, is that if in this moment I am okay and there isn't any huge problem, and perhaps there's something beautiful that I can concentrate on, like a hummingbird or the sunshine or a dog, then I'm happy.
Do you feel like your definition of happiness has evolved over your lifetime?
Yes, of course. When I was a kid, like 9, 10 years old, I used to think that happiness would come as I got older, and sure, that there would be a thing that would make me happy, like a boyfriend or a piano or a dog or a house. Mm-hmm. And I remember my sister telling my sister that I would be happier when I was older. And she said, no, she said, this is what it is. It's not going to change.
Right.
And I was quite disappointed in that. But obviously things do change. And in the middle part of my life, I probably didn't have much time to think about happiness because I was very, very busy.
Sure.
And I had to think of things again, minute by minute. And that's when I learned that technique. And now, honestly, if I wake up in the morning and the sun is out and there's no problems, I'm good to go.
That's a great approach. Tell me about your happiness right now. What brings you joy on a day-to-day basis?
Well, our family was just here, and it was really fun to see them happy. I was thinking about this morning because I knew we'd be talking. And my mother-in-law, who has long passed, used to say that she could only be as happy as her most unhappy child, and she had five of them. So there, that rotated, but it was an interesting thought. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I have learned to separate my emotions as much as I can from the emotional well-being of my kids, because I can just do what I can do and right. support them, and then they are responsible for that. I got talking about children. Oh, what makes me happy right now? Anyway, the family was here, and all the little kids, and they were rocking babies and playing with Legos, and that was a joy. I just published Sierra Blue. That was a very serious decision for me.
And you self-published it, right?
I did. I self-published it after years of telling people not to do that because they might be throwing their manuscript away. But I honestly think that times have changed, and we now have access to some really excellent publication methods that don't require that I have a book printed in China, at least not myself. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've developed a lot of good connections, and I feel supported. And honestly, to have that book in my hands has given me a lot of joy.
So, when did you start that project?
You're asking me that. 2009. It was a project that a very dear editor who I was working with and I brainstormed. And it took a long, long time to get the character, to find the character that I wanted to write about. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've revised it 3 or 4 times with different editors. And it didn't quite make it through all the processes of traditional publishing. So this spring, I met a woman from Las Vegas and at a conference of arts people. I'm a Nevada Arts Council artist in residence, and I got to go to this conference. And she said, "We're having an indie publishing contest. You should enter." And I said, "I don't have anything." And she said, "Could you?" And I thought of Sierra Blue because it had been waiting for mm-hmm. a long time. Right. I do have an agent, so I sent it to her first and said, "Is this going to make a problem?" And she said, "No." So I dove in, and it was a steep learning curve. But here it is, and I'm really excited about it.
That's wonderful. Was this story a freestanding novel, or is it intended to be a follow-up to Bull Rider?
Oh, it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with Bull Rider. The one thing that it does have to do with Bull Rider is that it's set in the interior West, near where I live. It is very much influenced by the mountains and the desert.
Got it.
And it's, I always think of Bull Rider as a boy taking responsibility and becoming a good young man. And mm-hmm. Sierra Blue, I think, is about a girl who is very uncomfortable with who she is and how she thinks people will receive her.
Got it.
And she steps into her own self and becomes the young woman she's meant to be.
That's a very relatable journey for a middle grade girl.
I hope so. I really am happy with it. I think that it's going to be a book that kids and their parents and their teachers will like.
I expect so as well. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. What gave you your last belly laugh?
I can't remember. We watch a lot of movies on TV, and I mm-hmm. remember there was something that made me laugh. I neither laugh nor cry easily. I smile a lot, mm-hmm. but I can't answer that.
That's okay. What's the weirdest thing that's ever made you happy?
Now, I thought about this one a lot because just, you know, full disclosure, Sonia said she was going to ask me that. And I'm like, what? And you know what? Here, I will reveal some things about me. I absolutely love color, which is, you will see if you read Sierra Blue, it's all about the colors. And if we had a video here, I would hold up these little shiny, colorful paper clips. I get a real kick out of choosing the color of paperclip that I will put on something that I give to someone. And to follow up on that, I also count almost everything in my head, which may be because my mother was a math teacher and she taught us to do that as a way of learning computation. But I continue to do it. I count steps, I count things, I count eggs, you name it, I'm counting it. It quietly. So to give me the happiest spot, you would give me a bowl of colorful M&Ms, chocolate, and I would be able to divide them by color, put the colors close together in a way that is appealing to me, and count them. So that's my weirdness.
That is the most teachery, adorable answer I feel like you could have given. And as soon as you said that, it reminded me of all of those celebrations in school, like hundreds a day. And I'm pretty sure one year when it was hundreds day, I brought in 100 M&Ms.
Oh, there you go.
Or arranged by color. That's awesome.
Well, that's me. That's what I like to do.
What's one word you associate with happiness and why?
Sunshine. I love the clear blue skies and the light. That's better. I like light.
Me too. It brings so much joy. I feel like there's no cost to having natural light in your space and no cost to basking in the sunshine. And those things that are just present are some of the best sources of happiness, I feel, and so easy to take for granted.
Well, and I would say the opposite of that is that if I think about some of the ways that I react to grief or loss,
mm-hmm.
sometimes I will close the curtains or I won't bother to put the light on.
Right.
You know, I think light is lovely.
How has your perspective on happiness been shaped by difficulty? And this could be any type of difficult or rough time.
I talked about it earlier. I have a difficult time dividing my own emotions from those of people that I love. And
like your children?
Yeah, or my husband, or you know, in the past, my parents. And I have had to learn what I said earlier, that at some point, adult people are responsible for their own decisions and their own happiness. And all I can do is support them to the extent that I am able. And I have also had to learn that there's a point where I am no longer able.
Right.
And that's been huge. I'd say that's taken me years to learn, and I'm still trying to deal with that. But that's a huge thing. And then, of course, there are these events that come from outside that nobody can control, where you simply have to find the moment that is okay. And in the middle of something very difficult, maybe take a second and enjoy the taste of a cup of coffee, or take a walk and find a squirrel and figure that they don't have the problems that you have, and isn't that lovely? And at the right. very bottom of it, I go minute by minute, and I have said this to my daughters. Okay, when you don't think you can do another second, you think in the next 5 minutes, I am going to be okay, and make it through. And you just keep doing that, and then pretty soon it can be 30 minutes. And anyway, I talk a lot, but that's what I do.
That makes a lot of sense. Breaking something down into more manageable chunks, or looking at just taking the next step, sometimes is the best approach when I feel like my head's spinning also. I'm also very big on breaking things down when they seem overwhelming. Which they sometimes do. What is your personal philosophy on happiness?
I think it has to do with, you know, I just talked about breaking things down into minutes and 5 minutes and 30 minutes and half a day. But honestly, when I really feel distressed, I try to think of myself in geologic or universal time, that my moment is not the only one, that there is a longer existence, that the rocks have been here for millennia. I do believe in things that are unseen. I am a Christian, but I believe that that's a way to frame that belief of unseen spiritual things. I don't believe it's the only way, which would distress some people, but it's my belief. And I try to think of happiness as a very long-term thing, and maybe not even a thing. It may just be a way of existing. And that gives me peace. I think peace and calm and satisfaction is more what I aim for now than giddy happiness. Joy is lovely. Joy is maybe the best.
I'm with you. I feel like at the end of the day, peace of mind is my most valued. I don't know if you'd call that an emotion, but like the most valuable feeling for me is to look in the mirror and feel at peace with myself and my choices and where things are. And anything that deters me from that, I try to bring back to center.
Sounds like a good plan.
How much do you prioritize happiness?
Well, a lot. I mean, I want to be happy and joyful. And I think a lot of it for me is in combination with other folks. Being able to talk to other people and create that sort of community joy. That said, I'm a writer and I spend a lot of time alone. And so I try to do things in order. And very often, this goes back to that counting stuff. Very often I try to do the hardest thing first in my day and get it over with.
Sure.
And then I can enjoy the rest of the day. And I have learned, for example, with people, if there are people that annoy me, that bring me grief, that don't still like me, I try to avoid that. I try to find and surround myself with the most positive and interesting people, and to get time outside to enjoy the garden and the natural things. So I guess I do prioritize it. I just don't think about it a lot.
That's nice. It's almost like a subconscious priority on happiness, or maybe part of your optimistic outlook.
Yeah, well, I do think a lot of this has to do with personality. I mean, you're a new mom.
Yeah.
And your baby came with a personality. I know it.
Oh, for sure.
And when I had my first daughter, I had no idea where that came from. And I thought, well, I guess it must be genetic. And then I had my second daughter and she was totally different. And I thought, well, how did this happen? And every, you know, we come with a lot of what we're going to be living with. And so I really do think I got a kind of a happy personality. I have a sister who I she's probably my best friend. And we know that she's going to see all the things that might go wrong. And I'm going to see, well, that hasn't happened yet.
Right. For our listeners at home, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, or SCBWI, has a category of members called PALs. They're not just friendly, but they're also published and listed authors, and Susie is one of these. You can be a published and listed author by going through the traditional publishing process, which includes finding an agent and getting acquired by an editor at a publishing house, where you have the editorial services, publishing, and marketing of a publishing house, be it traditional or indie. Or you can be self-published, where you take on the craft of writing and getting editorial services, choosing a publisher and releasing your book, and taking the leadership role on the marketing yourself. Susie has had experiences in both of these avenues, and her most recent publication, Sierra Blue, was self-published. And as somebody who's read it, it is a fantastic book.
For Susie, she is a champion not only of writing in both of these categories for herself, but encouraging others to do it. And in that very brief introduction, I wanted to ask you, Susie, what role does writing and the entire publishing journey play in your overall happiness?
Oh, boy. I've been doing it for 25 years. And so it's become part of my life and my personality. And as I said earlier, many, many of my dear friends are from the publishing and writing world. And at one point I was considering stopping. That was a long time ago. And I said to my husband, I don't think I can do it because I won't have any friends.
Right.
And so the process, though, I am at heart a pretty competitive person, and I have learned that some of what I liked about the traditional publishing route was the competition. That sure. if somebody picked me, then I could feel good, like, oh, I won. I won something. And to make this step to go into self-publishing of Sierra Blue, I needed to say to myself, I don't need to win that lottery or that competition. It's kind of a little bit of both luck and talent.
Sure.
And I can say, I know this is good. It's had a whole lot of, actually Sierra Blue's had a lot of editorial feedback. And I am going to do this myself. And I can't tell you how joyful it is to hand this book to someone, have them read it, love it, and know I made a good decision. But it was not a competitive one. It was based on confidence. It's confidence versus competition.
And a lot of strength, because there's a lot of risk involved, not only in going down the self-publishing road, but also the vulnerability of putting your story out there.
Yeah. And you know what? I had to decide, okay, this is maybe more than I should share, but I had to decide if I was going to create a publishing name, which might have cost me a little more money, which was part of that decision. And say, you know, have it published by SMW Books, or if I was going to put my own name in it. And as a member of the writing community, when I open a book and I see a publishing name like Cat Paw Prints, and my apologies to anyone who publishes Cat Paw Prints, but I see a name like that, and I wonder if the book is self-published, I can check on my phone and see how many books by whom Cat Paw Prints has published. And very often it's one author.
Sure.
So I thought, why are we going through that? So I put my name in it. When you open this book, it says published by Suzanne Morgan Williams. So I took the whole plunge. And one of the things that happens if you're not a writer and you're not a bookseller or a librarian, there is a lot of distrust of the self-publishing process, because some people make that decision because they want to make money quicker, or because they haven't spent the time mastering their craft, or at least not to the extent that some people think they should. So anyway, yeah, it's self-published. It's got my name in it. It's I'm really happy with it, and I love the cover.
It's beautiful, and it feels beautiful when you hold it. It's well made. Does anything or can anything compromise your happiness?
Well, we've talked about that. You know, there are these outside things.
Sure.
You know, I keep thinking about the children who are in war zones.
Right.
And I pray for them every night, whoever they are, and the adults too. I mean, this is the kind of thing that we cannot control.
Right.
And there's weather that, you know, brings in a hurricane or a flood or a fire.
Right.
And here in Reno, we had a situation a few years ago where an entire town, Paradise, California, burned down. And it's not too far from here. And
right.
I was in the store one day buying a candle. And the woman in front of me was buying mountains of dishes. And I was getting annoyed because there was only one clerk and she was wrapping every dish in tissue.
Right.
And I was thinking, couldn't you just have not been the person in front of me with my one candle?
Right.
And then she was talking to the clerk and she said, you know, the clerk said, well, you must be redoing your kitchen. And she said, no, my house, I lived in Paradise and my house burned down and now I've moved to Reno. And those are the kinds of things that, thank God, I have not experienced.
Right.
I guess one of the hardest things for me, besides having my children or my husband in some kind of emotional or physical pain, is when I feel betrayed by some kind of friendship. That's hard.
That is really hard. How do you counteract that or rebuild joy when you feel down?
Well, I just know that time helps.
Certainly. Absolutely.
I'll give you another example. When I was young, and I was in Boston. I was actually avoiding my life. And I went from the West Coast to Boston to work and play. And it was a lovely time. But I was pretty much alone. I had some friends, but they were busy with what they were doing. And at one point they had moved back to California and I was alone. And I got very, very depressed. And I could write a book about this, but there were a couple of things that happened. One is I was sitting on a wall on a street in Brookline, Massachusetts, and I was crying because I used to cry a lot more when I was 20. And this man came up to me and he just sat down next to me. And it wasn't creepy. It was just really nice. And so he basically handed me a tissue and I said something to him and he just looked at me and I said something else. And then he handed me a card and it said, I'm deaf. I speak sign language. And he was just sitting there with me.
That's so
and then
kind.
Later that in that same time, when I was so depressed, I decided I couldn't be that way anymore. There's a Bible verse, pick up your bed and walk. And I remember that. And I thought, you know, what would make me happy? This literally did happen. And I wrote down a list and I picked three things. And I decided I would do them. And it changed my outlook. I did it again when I was a young married woman and things were feeling bad. And I made a list. And on that list, I can tell you there was get a dog and play the piano.
Did you get a dog or play the piano?
I did get a dog and we did get a piano and I'm not that good at it, but our son turned out to be very, very talented and he plays the piano beautifully.
That's awesome. Do you have any advice for someone trying to cultivate happiness at home?
At home?
Well, basically for our listeners. So
for the listeners.
Yeah.
I would say one of the things that I learned, again, we're going through many decades of my life, but when I was in my 50s, I went to the Arctic to do a to do research. And while I was there, I interviewed a man named Mariano Apologic, who was an Inuit elder. And I had all these questions for him. They were being translated back and forth into Winnipeg in English by his son. And I kept asking questions. And finally, his son said, "My father has a question for you, and you're not going to like it." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "He wants to know how old you are." So I told him, and I think I was 53 or 54. And he told his father, and then he says, "Well, my father says he's older than you and you need to be quiet now."
That's so funny.
And so I said, "Okay, I have one last request, which is that I'm going to be sharing your story with children. So please let me know what you want the children in the U.S. to know." And then I was quiet. And really, it was the first time in my entire life where I was quiet without thinking about what I was going to say next. I just heard what he was saying. And I didn't even react much to it. I was taking notes. But I would say, in dealing with others, it's really important to listen and to take a minute or 10 before you respond. And that is really the antithesis of how we are raised. Imagine your classroom, going back to teaching, where your teacher asks a question and six people almost jump out of their chairs with their hands in the air, at least until fifth grade.
Right.
And the teacher calls them the first one. But it's the person who's processing it who isn't heard from. And I think we need more of that.
I love that. So, question that's unique to you, Susie. Do you have any advice for our listeners at home who are also aspiring writers? And I guess, as somebody who's not yet published but actively writing, I would prefer to call myself a writer rather than an aspiring writer, but maybe any writer at home that's aspiring to get published, I should say.
Right. We often refer to this as pre-published writers, because we assume that if you want to be published, that if you learn your craft and spend some time, that it may happen. My best advice is to take your time. It's not a race. Although part of my decision to self-publish did come from my age at this point, that it's not a race, but at some point you may run out of time. But assuming you're not my age, take your time, learn your craft. Remember that opinions are subjective, and you need to know what your vision is, and then take the time to process the feedback that you get on your work and match it to your vision or not. And I will say that I think I'm pretty good at listening to feedback and saying, "Oh, yes, I'll consider that." But then it may take me 6 months to really put it into effect.
Sure.
And I've never been able to write a successful book really quickly, with the exception of some nonfiction books that were fairly small. So give yourself time. Take classes. Surround yourself with positive people and people who you admire their writing. And then write. You need to write, and you need to love words, and you need to believe that you have something to say. And one of the things I tell people when I teach a class is, you have a story that only you can share. Even if it's the same, Cinderella, the 79th time, your version, your vision is your own and it's unique, and it deserves to, you deserve to honor it. But it may take time before you get it to a place that someone will want to publish it. And I would say this for people who are considering self-publishing too, that take your time, because you do, if you take that step, you want it to be the best it can be.
Thank you so much, Susie.
Well, thanks for having me here. This has been lovely and thought-provoking and sometimes a little difficult, but I did come out feeling like I'm a pretty happy soul.
Thank you for conversing on Common Happiness with Sonia Kencare. And if you like this episode, please subscribe.